For tonight's class, we're going to be, unlike last week with the sheet that we had to pass out, we're going to be flipping back and forth a little bit. So we probably need to line up three helpers. We should get somebody lined up for Mark chapter 14. If you'll have your hand in Mark chapter 14, but also be following along in Matthew 26. Sherman, I saw you first. Carol, if you will pick up for us Luke chapter 22 and have your hand there, and then also try to stay in Matthew chapter 26 as far as the main text. That'll get us through the parallel accounts, and we'll pull from those as needed, and then we'll also be looking, hopefully a little bit later, at some of the information in John chapter 18. We don't know. When we think about the prayer of Jesus in the garden, we don't know exactly how long that prayer took place. Now, you might at first glance be inclined to think, well, Jesus, he goes, he says, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. That sounds like that would last all of 30 or 60 seconds, and then he was done. I don't think it was quite that fast for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons would be in Matthew 26, 40 and 41, where we're going to read from in just a minute. You have here, or Luke chapter 22, verse 41, rather. Luke 22, verse 41, you have the word prayed expressed with a present tense. That's continuous. That's ongoing action. You also have Jesus withdrawing. That is an aorist tense word and a verb, and there is a distinction there between the two. So it took a little time for him to withdraw, but still that's described with the aorist tense. And contrasting that with the praying tense, the present tense with that particular term, it seems to me that that may be one way to say that the prayers took a period of time. Now, was it 5 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour? We simply don't know. But he did pray three times. Where we left off last time was the cup. Jesus said, let this cup pass from me. The point that I concluded with, and the point that I'd like to reintroduce tonight as far as getting back into the swing of things, is this. Had people been beaten before the Lord was beaten? Yes. Had people been crucified before Jesus was crucified? Yes. Do you think some people had been beaten and crucified before Jesus was beaten and crucified? Yes. Do you think some people had been verbally assaulted and beaten and crucified before Jesus was verbally assaulted and beaten and crucified? Yes. So when he says, let this cup pass from me, it seems to me that those words must mean something more than I'm going to be verbally abused and I'm going to be beaten and I'm going to be crucified. If there's not more meaning there, then it seems to me, and take this in the spirit in which it said, but Jesus was a bit of a crybaby, because he was going to go through what other people had gone through, and they got through it. Now, granted, it wasn't that pleasant for him, but still, there has to be something more there. And I suggested, and I think this is how you want to look at the cup that he talks about. The cup is not just the suffering. In fact, that might have been the most tolerable part of it, the whole thing. But the cup was, I'm paying the full price for sin. I'm facing the wrath of God for sin. So the physical suffering was certainly part of that, but there were probably some other things as far as maybe items beyond our comprehension that were taking place in the Godhead that may just simply be far beyond us to grasp. But when you think about that cup, we talk about how we suffered, and that's true. But there had to be more to that because several other people had gone through those exact same things as far as the physical consequences. Carol? Yes, I mean, that does factor into that. But still, you can have innocent people who are verbally assaulted, physically beaten, and crucified. But in his case, he was perfectly innocent. So you could throw that in there too. Anybody else before we dig into the text? Okay, let's start with Matthew 26, looking at verses 40 and 41. And you've got him, that first prayer back there in verse 39 where we stopped last week. It goes for a little, falls on his face, prays, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass away from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Then 40, and he cometh unto the disciples, and findeth them sleeping, and saith unto Peter, what could thou not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Now, if you were to look at the other account, this is going to be Mark chapter 14, verse 36. Sherman, are you there and can read that for us, Mark 14, 36?
Yes, sir. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will.
Okay, Mark has a couple of details which we don't find in Matthew and Luke. For example, how does he address the Father in Mark chapter 14? He says, Abba. That is that word for dear. Some people try to equate that to daddy. I don't think that is quite what is being expressed with Abba, but it is a strong term of endearment. So Mark tells us that. And then Mark says, too, what? All things are possible with God. Now, I find that to be very, very interesting. As Jesus begins to pray about what was coming, he says, how many things are possible with God? All things. But did he take that truth and draw from it that, well, this is a thing, me going to the cross, therefore I'm not going to go? All things were possible, but not all things were going to be done. All things were not going to be possible as far as getting some things to go a certain way if God's will were to be accomplished. Now, do you see a parallel between that and what people sometimes say today? A person says, well, God is all powerful, so what can he do? Whatever he wants. Well, now, wait a minute. Here again, you have the same idea. All things are possible. God can do all things, but that does not mean that this is allowed or this is going to be permissible, for God can't make himself exist and not exist at the same time. Logical contradictions are not possible. So Jesus does make that admission. He goes back to the disciples, the inner three. He finds them sleeping. And let's see what else we find in Mark 14. Mark 14, verse 40.
And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer him.
Okay, let's come back to that. But their eyes were heavy. They were very, very sleepy at this time. Now, when you have Jesus, he's specifically referring to Peter, and I think you may see a hint here. Talks to Peter, and Peter had that name, which meant what? Rock. How much of a rock was Peter on this occasion? He's taking a nap. I mean, you would think that if your name means rock or stone, even though you're going through some difficult times, what's going to be true of you? Everybody else might fail, but if you're the stone, you're the rock, what should be true of you?
Strong.
I'm going to be strong. I'm the fellow who's not going to be sleeping. Now, Jesus, because the plural is used, does address all three disciples. But I find it very, very interesting that the only one of the three that is specifically addressed by name is Peter, the one who was stoned. And maybe that was just a very gentle rebuke to Peter, the other two as well. But maybe it was a very gentle reminder to Peter that you're not quite as advanced as you thought you were. And that happens today. People sometimes think, I've really arrived, I'm an overachiever, I have this all under control. And sometimes people need to be reminded that that is not quite true. All right, Jesus asked his special friends if they could not, what, for an hour? If you could not watch. Now we see that word back in verse 38 as well. Then saith he unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Abide ye here and watch with me. Now back there in verse 38, when he says watch, the sense there is don't go to sleep. You need to stay awake. But as you come down to verses 40 and 41, you have the same word that's being used. But now the meaning of it seems to change just a bit. And is there anything in 40 and 41 that points that out to you? That watch here means more than avoid going to sleep? 41, you watch and you pray, lest you enter into temptation. And when you look at that additional information, that I think is an indication that Jesus was saying, there's more here than you're just going to sleep. There is the possibility of temptation. So you need to be people who are watching and praying on this occasion. I find it interesting that when you look at this, you have a combination here. It's not mentioned too many times in Scripture, but prayer should naturally go hand in hand with what other activity? You're praying about something, you should also be watching. Anybody ever pray when they drift asleep? You're not too watchful, you're just kind of praying and then... That happens sometimes. So we might pray, but we're not too watchful. But Jesus associated the two things here as joining them together, and that would be good for us. When you look at this word, which is translated watch, it's also used in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Peter said that your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, so you need to be watchful when it comes to him. So the Lord said you can be overtaken in temptation. What do you think the temptation might have been? You need to watch. Not just stay awake, but be on the alert. Because what temptation is on the horizon?
The one that Judas is going to be bringing to see him at that point, too.
Yeah. You're already tired. Maybe mentally you're not quite as sharp as you would be had you been rested. Judas and the disciples that he has, the soldiers show up, John chapter 18, verse 2 and following, and what might you as an apostle do? Yeah, run, and not just run, you might just keep on running. Think, I've been, you know, with him for about 3.5 years, but this is just too much to take, and we're going to jump ship. Well, Jesus didn't need that. Certainly, that was not going to fulfill heaven's plan. So Jesus offers this gentle correction. And what's he say? He says the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Then you have, going back to Mark's sermon, Mark chapter 14, verse 40. Let's see what Mark has there as far as an additional point.
And when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. They did not know how to answer him.
Okay, let's concentrate now on the last part of that. He found them sleeping. They did not know how to answer. Do you think they really knew how to answer? You think they knew what the problem was?
Yeah.
They did. So it wasn't that they were ignorant about the problem. What was the issue?
They were guilty.
They were guilty. So here when he says they knew not how to answer, what's that mean?
They didn't want to answer.
Yeah, embarrassed. It's just like, I'm guilty. We're caught. You know, we did it. And you just don't know what to say. And I think most people have probably been in that set of circumstances. Now, as you think about all this, do you remember how earlier in the book of Luke, chapter 6, verses 12 and 13, what did Jesus do the night before he selected the apostles? Anybody remember? Luke 6, 12 and 13. The whole night. I wonder if in that prayer, perhaps he was thinking, what's going to happen with these guys? Whoever I pick, what's going to happen with them? And if he was thinking about that, you wonder, at least I wonder, if maybe he was looking forward to the Garden of Gethsemane. Are these guys going to run? Are they going to stay? They had some failures, but do you think other men may have failed worse? I think other people, we might not have done nearly half as well as these three did. So they were not perfect by any means, and you know they could have gotten higher marks. But Jesus picked the right guys, and they did stick with him, even though they had some bumps in the road. For us, I think one of the practical lessons before we look at Matthew 26, 42 to 44, is that we too have sometimes very willing minds, but the flesh is weak. That is, the body has some natural limitations. And those limitations cause us to do some things or not do some things. Or in some cases, we know what's right, and we just don't do those things as quickly, as immediately, or maybe as fully as we should. This idea, the mind is willing, but the flesh is weak, is that an excuse for sin? Correct. People will sometimes say, well, you know how people are, you know how I am, whatever it might be. So people do rely on that and at work. For example, people will sometimes say, well, you know, this is, you're just going to have to get used to this. I'm this, I'm that, or I'm not this, I'm not that. But God says, well, okay, if that's true, then you need to work on motivation. You need to work on overcoming that. It may be a battle. One other quick point from verse 41. The adjective that is translated willing, he says the mind is willing. Remember over there in Romans chapter 1, verse 15, Paul said, I'm willing to come and preach the gospel to you at Rome. I'm ready to come and preach the gospel to you at Rome. That's the same word that we have here in Matthew 26, verse 41. So the mind was ready. These fellows, they wanted to do what was right. Peter surely wanted to be that rock, but there was this mental exhaustion, and they were just so wiped out that they went to sleep. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at 42 to 44? Gary?
Each of these times that he says to watch, is he saying to watch out so that you don't fall into temptation? Is that what he means?
I would go back to 38 and start there and say he meant by watch, don't fall asleep. And that was how it started. And then as you move down into 40 and 41, watch, you probably still have that connotation, but you have the additional meaning of there's danger present, danger for you. And now that watching, you need to not only stay awake, but you need to be sensitive. You need to be mindful of the fact that danger is nearby and be on your guard. So it's, I would say that the meaning is amplified or intensified as the events unfolded.
Was the temptation here, does it explain what it was? Is it that they might betray Jesus?
I think, and this goes back to what Ray said earlier, you don't have a specific explanation for that, but when you look over succeeding events in John 18, verses 2 and following, Judas shows up, and Mark, I believe, uses the word straight away or immediately. Luke, let's see if we can find it a little early, Carol. Luke chapter 22, maybe around verse 40, as he was speaking these words, let's see if we can find that. I think that's in Luke's account. Let's go down to 47, if you would.
While he was still speaking, behold, a multitude came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him.
Okay, thank you. This is after Jesus comes back the third time. Finished up his prayer, he's come back talking to the disciples, and as he's having the discussion, who shows up? Judas and the apostles, or Judas and the traitors, to get Jesus and the apostles. So, that's why I say, contextually, I think that temptation, Jesus knew that that was at hand, that that was just around the corner, so to speak, and for him, that was a temptation. That, you know, going back to Gary's point, you need to stay awake, and you need to be really careful, because Judas is showing up, and there's great danger here. Back to you.
Yeah, kind of what I was saying, it says, watch with me, so does Jesus say that he's possible that he could have been tempted? I mean, I guess he was tempted, but it's just, I don't know, I never thought about Jesus actually saying, I'm watching too because I might fall into temptation.
Right, we don't know how many people came. I am inclined to believe, and this is getting ahead of us a little bit, but I'm inclined to believe that there were between 600 and 1,000 people that came for the Lord. Let's just say that there were... We'll get to that. Like, that's to say, we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. But let's just say you've got 500 people coming out after you, and it's a mob. Even with Jesus, I think that would have gotten his attention. And certainly for the disciples, when you have that large of a group, we saw, didn't we, some of the riots, the latest police riots over, wasn't it, Charlotte, North Carolina? I don't know how many, is that where it was? They were trashing police cars? Okay, within the last 24 hours, you see a group that size and the damage that they can do. And here you are, you're without any kind of, again, Jesus was obviously in a special category, but you're without weapons, you have these people coming for you. Now, it's a scary thing. So you want to make sure that you are fully awake and hopefully trying to deal with the matter in a good way. But yes, hundreds of people were on the way, maybe close to 1,000 people. And it was time to make sure that all your mental faculties were engaged and you weren't out of it. Don?
Struggling with the temptation. What were they supposed to be tempted of? What was Jesus talking about? These three men would be tempted of. Judas was tempted because he'd already been tempted, but I don't know what.
Yeah. Unfaithfulness to the Lord, in some respect, I think would be the best general answer that I could give as the crowd shows up. Was there a hand over there? Betty. I think you get back there to the commitment aspect of it, that he was concerned that there was going to be some denial, some running away that maybe they wouldn't come back from, but there was going to be a challenge to the faith that when he was picked up by this group, how are you guys going to act? And you need to be prepared for that. So you can, I think, tie all those ideas in there. I'll come back to you, Don, but I saw Dolores next. And that's why I say high alert. Even when you are in that heightened alert state, you may not always make the right decisions. But there were going to be some very, very tense moments that followed shortly after these prayers. And if these fellows were not on the toes, it could have gone, I mean, it didn't go that great. Peter gets out the sword and so forth, and Jesus has to sort of do a little pushback, if you will. But it could have gone a lot worse. Don?
Yeah. Protect the Lord.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you know it. Maybe he wasn't supposed to be attended that way?
Yeah, and again, you know, you've got some things as far as commitment. Ideally, you're going to be going down this road, but sometimes people can run. Sometimes people can make a stand where you don't need to make a stand. And they needed to get it right, and Jesus had to help them a little bit. Okay, let's pick up with 42 to 44, same chapter, Matthew 26. 42 says, again, a second time, he went away and prayed, saying, My Father, if this cannot pass away except I drink it, thy will be done. And he came again and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying again these same words. Jesus goes away. We've talked about the first prayer. Goes away, prays the second time. And initially, you may look at the prayers, and maybe this has been your view over the years, that he basically says the same words. Now, there are certainly some similarities, and Matthew does make that point, that he does convey several of the same thoughts. He speaks to the Father both times. He focuses on the cup. Now, depending on how your translation reads, you may or may not have a reference to the cup in verses 42 through 44. If you do and the person beside you does not, there's a reason for that. There is a manuscript variation. So you might have the cup implied. The ASV implies the cup. The King James actually uses the word cup. But there is that difference. Some have it, some do not, because of a manuscript variation. And the Lord was also very, very interested in the Father's will. Now, while the language is very similar, and you do find the same concepts being expressed, as you look at verses 39 and 42, is there anything that is significantly different as Jesus issues these two prayers?
Unless I drink it.
Okay, there is that. Anything else?
One says let, one says
if. Okay. 39 says, if it be possible. 42 says, if this cannot pass away. Do you see the difference? If this is possible, I want to go this way. But if that can't happen, that's kind of the second step in 42. If this can't happen, then what am I willing to do? I'm ready to submit to the Father's will. See, you sort of see, even though the very same ideas are being expressed, you begin to see, we talked about this before last week, but from a different angle. Remember, you've got Jesus kneeling, and then he ends up falling down, face down on the ground. There is that graduation as far as the posture in his prayer. Now you have a graduation. Now you have increasing intensity when it actually comes to the prayer. If it's possible, this is what I want. But if it's not possible, part two of the prayer, then I'm ready to do what your will is. Now, some believe that Jesus said more in the second prayer because when he comes back, we pick this up from verse 33, the disciples are still sleeping. Now, that's possible. Maybe Jesus went away, and even though he's saying in the second prayer several more things, even though it's pretty much the same material, maybe he's praying long enough that the disciples not off to sleep. But anybody ever had what might be called uncontrolled drowsiness? How does that work? You know, you're talking to somebody 1 minute, and what happens? I mean, you just turn your head, and they're zonked out. That may have been what we have here with the disciples. That's sort of, I mean, he may have prayed a long time the second time. I don't have any reason not to believe that. But at the same time, I'm also inclined to think that they may have just been so tired. And there were some reasons for that. We'll mention those after a little bit. I do want to tell you this, though. The word that's translated heavy, and I mentioned this earlier from what Sherman mentioned, this is the same word that we have in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. Let's head over there and take a look at that. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. Just looking at that passage, you wouldn't think that there'd be any relation to the heaviness of the apostles' eyes. But it's the exact same word. Who's got it? 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. Gary. Okay, here were some ladies who had some family members, and there were some people who had some financial needs within the church. And Paul said, work on relieving those needs so the church is not charged. That's the same word. What can happen if you've got a bank account and your expenses are fairly regular throughout the year, but you come to next month and the expenses are just really heavy? I mean, extra money for medicine, cars broken down, need a new refrigerator, and there's three other things that are major bills. What happens to the bank accounts? You know, you can just see it starting to take a big hit. And that's the idea there. Let not the church be charged. You know, let not the church be burdened. Let not the church be, bearing this heavy load, if you will. So if you can appreciate the financial idea, in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16, you can get an idea of what was taking place with the disciples. I mean, there was this great state of weariness. What do you think may have caused that?
In the case of Peter and John, they were the ones who were commissioned by Jesus to go prepare the Passover.
All right.
So they had extra duties that they had done that day.
All right. Yeah. And if you've been involved with any kind of big meal, it takes some zip out of you. So there was that. What else? What happened during the meal? What did Jesus say? I got to leave. And it's not good. I mean, you're going to have some difficult times. The Holy Spirit's going to come. Remember the John chapter 14 discussion, John chapter 16? And he's going to help you. But I'm going to die. You're going to suffer. There are going to be some difficult times. You've heard some very strange things, things that didn't sound too encouraging. Now you're out with Jesus in this area with the disciples. He's praying. And I wonder if these fellows didn't have some pretty good instincts. In spite of everything else, maybe they're able to get a sense that this is kind of a bad period. We don't know exactly what's going to take place, but there was maybe that feeling, that foreboding feeling, and they knew that some things were going to be difficult. So that word is translated heavy, same term that we find in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 16. Then, and Carol, we're coming to you now, going to go back to you. We've got Jesus' third and final prayer in verse 44 of Matthew chapter 26, and he's going along the same lines, using the same words, but now we have a clear change in intensity. Let's see from Luke chapter 22 what we've got in verse 44.
And being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down on the ground.
Thank you. Agony, you may have a different word in your translation, but that's probably going to be one of the more common terms. He is now in agony. He prays not just a third time, but he prays how? He prays more earnestly. So praying intently, praying earnestly before, but now this is increasing. And then Luke goes on to say this, his sweat became as it were great drops of blood falling on the ground. Now if you've ever thought about that or tried to envision that, what might initially come to the mind? Okay, there is that. Anything else? When a person says, hey, I'm bleeding, what might come to mind? Yeah, when somebody says that, it might be just a little cut. Or when somebody says that, you might think that blood is gushing out everywhere, and I better go and, you know, get some duct tape or something to wrap the arm up because it's really bad. So you don't know exactly what that means. So when you see the expression there in Luke chapter 22, verse 44, his sweat became, as it were, great drops of blood, I think sometimes people envision that there's something like blood all over the ground, but that may be going a little bit too far. I can tell you that nothing is said elsewhere than Luke chapter 22, verse 44, about his sweat becoming his blood. So it does not seem to me that this happened in prayer 1, prayer 2. It is reserved for this prayer. And it's also at this time, Carol, let's go back and look at verse 43 as well in that 22nd chapter of Luke.
Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him.
Okay. Who was this angel? We don't know. Exactly. How did the angel strengthen the Lord? I don't know. Did the angel speak comforting words? I don't know. Put a hand on him? I don't know. But whatever this angel did, whoever this angel was, it was apparently capable and able and did strengthen the human side of the Lord. Now going back to the sweat like blood, a lot of people have asked about that, and there is a medical term, I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, hematidrosis, the excretion of bloody sweat, and people, that is a known condition when there is great psychological stress in the body, that is something that has been seen. One source said severe anxiety causes the release of chemicals that break down the capillaries in the sweat glands. As a result, there is, and I'll emphasize this, there's a small amount of bleeding into these glands, and the sweat comes out tinged with blood. We're not talking about a lot of blood. It's just very, very small amount. And a follow-up point on that, but I do think that's important, that when you see this, it's not like he's losing a pint or two of blood, and there wasn't much left. So very serious condition. A very unusual condition, and it certainly helps illustrate the severity of what was taking place. One other quick point, Don, then I'll take your thought. When you look at this condition, as far as my understanding of it, it is a state where the body is very sensitive. So if you consider that fact and then remember that shortly after this time, Jesus is going to be beaten, I think a lot of people could have just died from the beating because of what's taking place with the body. So Jesus had to be a very strong man. Maybe that was part of his prayer, that you know, and maybe the angel strengthening was also associated with this. But it was a very, very intense experience, no matter how you look at it. Don?
Jesus took the sins of the world, past, present, and future. He was on the cross, right? And he was separated from God for a period of time, right?
Well, let's kind of put a footnote there. I want to talk about the word separation and see how you're defining that, but let's continue with the question.
Okay. In light of that, that's true. That would have been the first time he's ever separated from his father, and the only time. Could it not be that he was in agony, was being separated from his father for that short period of time, however how long it was?
Is that the entire question?
That's my question.
Okay. All right, I'm going to divide that question up into two points. Jesus' involvement with sin, even not that, you know, people say he became sin. No, he didn't become sin. Now, in Romans, Paul says he became sin. The idea there is he became a sin offering. He became an offering for sin. But when you are, anybody remember the little rodent, the animal that's white? And it's will do just about anything to get its fur cleaned. Anybody remember that creature? That's not going to work as far as...
Is it a kid's story?
No, there's really an animal. Has white fur. And getting its fur dirty is really bad. It doesn't want dirty fur and will do just about anything to clean itself. So I can't call the name of that animal right off, so that's not going to work as far as helping with this point. But, you know, Jesus, he's perfect, he's holy. The last thing that he or any member of the Godhead wants is to be involved with sin. And here he is, he's paying the price for sin. That had to be agonizing. And that's why I say when you go back and you look at the cup, when he talks about the cup, or Mark's version of it in Mark 14 is, the hour is come. That had to be distressing on the fullest level to be, knowing, as Carol said earlier, you're perfect, you're innocent in every way, and you're the one who's going to be paying the price for that. Now people have different ideas as far as Jesus being separated from the Father. I know there are some people who would say, well, Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And they would say that that proves Jesus was separated from the Father. Well, that is a possible explanation. Is that the only explanation? I'm not persuaded that that is the only alternative for a couple of reasons. We argue on one hand that God is where? Everywhere. All right. You've maybe heard someone say that God closed the door to heaven and didn't look on Jesus. Well, I scratch my head a little bit and wonder how you can reconcile that statement with the belief that God is everywhere. I don't see how those two things go together. If you have an omnipresent God, he's in all places at all times, how he was able to take that little section of Palestine and say, okay, I'm going to withdraw my presence from there. And maybe there's an explanation for that. Two, when you go back and you look at Psalm 22, you have Psalm 22, Psalm 23, and Psalm 24 connected. Those three psalms go together. And you specifically have information. We can go back and look at it if you want. Notice how it starts. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Well, we know what that pointed forward to, and that, of course, was Jesus on the cross. And let's continue to read it. But he says that's what you find in that first verse. He said, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? And from the words of my groaning, my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou answerest not. So this also had relation to David, not just Jesus. And in the night season am I not silent, but thou art holy. O thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel, our fathers trusted in thee. They trusted, and thou didst deliver them. They cried unto thee, and were delivered. They trusted in thee, and were not put to shame. But I am a worm, and not a man, a reproach of men, and despise of the people. And they that see me laugh me to scorn. Well, we see that with Jesus on the cross, don't we? People looked at him, laughed at him, mocked him, and so forth. They shoot out the lip, they shake the head, saying, commit thyself unto Jehovah, let him deliver him. Well, once again, you can find that in connection with the crucifixion. Let him rescue him, seeing he delighteth in him. But thou art he that took me out of the womb. thou didst make me trust when I was upon my mother's breast. I was cast upon thee from the womb. Thou art my God, since my mother bare thee. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have compassed me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round. They gape upon me with their mouth, and ravening, and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It melted within me. My strength is dried up like a pot shred, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws. And thou hast brought me into the dust of the earth. For dogs have compassed me. A company of evildoers have enclosed me. They pierce my hands and my feet. Again, you can see the cross imagery. I may count all my bones. They look and stare upon me. They part my garments among them. We're familiar with that. And upon my vesture do they cast lots. But be thou not far off, O Jehovah. O thou my succor, haste thee to help me. Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth. Yea, from the horns of the wild oxen. Thou hast answered me. I will declare thy name unto the brethren. In the midst of the assembly will I praise thee. Yet are ye that fear Jehovah, praise him. And all the seed of Jacob glorify him. And stand in awe of him, all ye seed of Israel. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. Neither hath he hid his face from him. But when he cried unto him, what? He heard. Now we could continue to read through that, but especially that last verse. It seems to me, my God, why have you forsaken me? Things have been really bad. I feel like I'm out here all alone. But when he cried, he heard me. So I can say I understand why people would look at the place where Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? But if you go back into the Old Testament and you see where that originates from, Psalm 22, and you read that psalm all the way through, and you start looking at what the psalmist says, you can at least build a case for an alternative view. So that's why I say when people say, well, you know, God turned his face from him, I'm a little hesitant to walk down that road. At least I'm willing to affirm and do affirm that there is a second opinion on that. But as far as Jesus feeling forsaken, no doubt about that. The weight that he felt, the weight that he felt when it came to the cross, absolutely no question on that point. Well, let's explore that as well. We've heard that statement made over the years. Was God aware of what took place in Sodom and Gomorrah? Not only was he aware of what happens, you've got some personal visitation down there. Well, again, I have to go back and ask. Based on that, somebody says, well, God can't have any association with sin. He's not only aware of what's taking place. Jude talks about how Sodom and Gomorrah, they're examples of everlasting punishment. He's actually down there in the midst. Well, as far as Sodom and Gomorrah, the strangers that showed up to Abraham, you know, they said, let's go over and investigate. From a human perspective, they obviously knew what was taking place down there. When you think about Noah, was God aware of what was taking place in that day and time? Yes. And today, you know, for God to charge people with sin, what's required? I mean, he's got to know. You just can't say, well, I suspect he's guilty of these 10 things, and let's go ahead and charge him for wrongdoing. So when people make that statement, they may mean something by it, other than what I understand them to mean. But generally, when I hear that, at least my understanding of it is, I can't reconcile that with what I find in Scripture. Now, if you're talking about, you know, God doesn't participate in sin. For example, if someone said, well, you know, God help me rob the bank. You know, I don't want to get caught. I really want the money. God's not going to participate in that. He's not going to line things up miraculously or providentially, miraculously in the past, providentially now, to make sure that the person gets away and nobody's hurt. So there certainly would not be that. But as far as seeing sin, being there in the midst of sin as far as knowing what's taking place, you've got to have that understanding when you start looking at biblical events.
The only difference between all of your examples is that Jesus was his God.
Yes.
And I think, you know, like Carol, you might have heard the same thing, and kind of, you know, God didn't want to see the sin because Jesus was God. Okay. in all the other examples, you and I, we sin. God sees that Jesus will sin here, though, so that we can have the forgiveness of the sin. I just see a little difference there.
Okay, and you do have to recognize that Jesus, as I said, he is the Son of God. He was paying the price for sin, all of those things. As you think through that, you could add in some other considerations as well. Who do you think brought the darkness over the land? All right, God the Father. But if God the Father's presence had been withdrawn because he wasn't looking on Jesus. Now again, this is trying to take spiritual things and put them into physical terms, which there are plenty of problems as far as trying to do that. But he's obviously present there when he's doing some of the things that take place on the cross. So would you find someone, and I've never asked anybody to try to get this specific, but he wasn't looking at Jesus on the cross, he was looking at the land, and he's willing to tear the temple apart as far as the curtain there, and he's willing to put blackness on the land. But this particular, you know, 6x6 spot, Jesus is on the cross, that's just completely blocked out from him. Now, that sounds a little ridiculous from my standpoint, and the person hearing that would probably say that sounds ridiculous. But again, what exactly do you mean when you say God turned his face away, withdrew his presence? He certainly was there. When you think about the blackness and the other things, did Jesus feel some separation from the Father? Yes. Was there some kind of change within the Godhead? I don't know. But when you look back at Psalm 22... it seems to me that what people have sometimes said is very difficult, at least in part, to reconcile with that 22nd Psalm. And that's all I'm pointing out, I guess, because it does begin, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And if we look at that and how it continues on, the story goes a little more fully than what maybe some have been led to believe. Stan, I think you were first, and then Don will take you.
We're supposed to be a sanctified people. Christians are to be set aside. We're to be in the world, but not of the world. Jesus was in the world. He wasn't of the world. God is the epitome of that. He's in the world. He's not of the world.
Correct.
You could substitute sin for the word world, and I think you have the idea.
Yeah. And I think that would be what people are trying to convey with that point that Carol made earlier. You know, he's there, but he's not of, he's not participating in that sense. Don?
Okay. Forsaken. Is that in all the translations, that word forsaken? As far as your knowledge, most of the translations.
Let me look at that. I promise we'll begin next week's class with the word forsaken. I'll take a look at that, and it's going to require just a little looking on my part, see where it is, and come up with some good definitions for it. So I may already have that in some advanced notes, but it's not in my head, and I don't want to guess on that. So that's where we'll begin next week, and then we'll take a look at Matthew 26:45 and 46. We've got a couple minutes left. Gary, we'll take your thoughts.